Modular Robotics with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. And welcome to the 91st episode of Robots. I'm Jana, and today we will be hearing from our new collaborator Per Sjoborg, who went to speak to Martin Nielsen about his fascinating work around snake robots. But first, let's take a look at the latest news and developments in robotics. Honda has introduced an updated version of its Asimo humanoid robot. While appearing quite similar at first glance, this new version is more than 10% lighter, 50% faster when running, is stronger, and has more than twice the degrees of freedom compared with the previous model. It can hop with both feet or holding one foot suspended while hopping on the other, and can also walk across uneven surfaces without losing its balance. The new Asimo's hands are dexterous enough to perform sign language and can accomplish delicate tasks such as holding a paper cup while pouring a liquid into it. With the ability to integrate data from multiple sensors and to make intelligent predictions, the new Asimo is capable of safely operating autonomously side by side with humans. Honda also introduced the new trademark Honda Robotics, which will represent all of its robotics technologies and product applications. Researchers at the German Aerospace Center's Institute of Robotics and Mechatronics, led by Christian Ott, have been applying technology developed for grasping to the problem of balance and bipedal locomotion. Their experimental system, called the DLR Biped, utilizes torque-controlled rather than position-controlled motors. Ott's presentation describing this research, entitled Posture and Balance Control for Biped Robots Based on Contact Force Optimization, was awarded Best Paper at the recently held 11th Robotics and Automation Society International Conference on Humanoid Robots. If you want to learn more about walk-in robots, check out Paul Miller's extensive robotics article, posted November 8th on The Verge. It centers on the work of Professor Dennis Hong of Virginia Tech, but also discusses the RoboCup competition and the difficulties involved in creating human-scale bipedal robots. Per Sjoborg has his own blog called Flexible Envelope, which focuses on self-reconfiguring modular robotics. He has now joined forces with us at the Robots Podcast to bring you the latest news in this area of robotics. His first contribution is an interview with Martin Nielsen from the Swedish Institute of Computer Science. Martin Nielsen has worked on exciting projects such as the Dragon, distributed real-time autonomously guided organisms project, in the 1990s and early 2000s. His focus was on modular robotics, the connector, and locomotion. He talked to Per about his early work on snake robots and about the progress and challenges of modular robotics.
So, welcome, Dr. Nielsen.
Thank you.
Could you begin by introducing yourself to our listeners? You worked with especially the connectors and also snake modular robotics joints 10 years ago, is that correct?
Yes, from the beginning of the 90s to 2001 approximately. I had a lot of focus on snake robots, various aspects, both the control and the physical design of these robots. And as I see it, a snake robot has two main components, and that is the joint and the connector. Mm-hmm. And I spent quite a lot of work on developing prototypes on each of those.
Mm-hmm. The connector is, of course, general because it applies to all modular robotics. We all need them. They're not specific to the snake robot. So we'll talk about those a bit later, I guess. Could we talk about why you were interested in the snake robot and then go over to the joint? Because I understand that that's a critical component for the snake.
Yeah. The interesting with the snake robot is that it has so many different modes of motion. Mm-hmm. If you look at biological snakes, they are very impressive animals. They have all kinds of amazing ways of moving themselves. And they are very well adapted to moving in very rough terrain.
Even climbing trees. And
climbing trees, they can fly, they can swim, they can...
walk on sand, yeah, which is very hard.
The rattlesnakes, sidewinding motion of rattlesnakes where they roll as a kind of spiral. It's very, very impressive, and it would be very nice if we could make robots work in a similar way.
For the locomotion part.
Yes.
One thing I was thinking of when we have a snake, when the locomotion part is that snakes are cylindrical. Do you think that, for instance, the sidewinding motions could be applied to a surface that was, for instance, a sheet rather than a tube? Do you think that the same could be used there to distribute the load over a larger surface?
Yeah, I think that the geometry of a snake robot, the geometry of the cross section does not matter terribly much, especially in rough terrain. In smooth terrain, it's probably an advantage if the cross section is circular. But it's not, from my point of view, it's not a very critical factor. Yeah.
That's interesting. Because, of course, if we're going to have these robotic systems, they probably have tasks at different locations. So we have to move from one location to the other, and we need to do that in as many ways as possible to be able to choose the one that is best.
Yeah, and one nice thing with a snake robot is you have the option of choosing various kinds of motion depending on the environment.
Yeah, and as far as I know, when we come to modular robotics, there's also a couple of gates that regular biological snakes can't do. They can form the wheel and become one continuous large wheel and then reach, as far as I know, reasonably impressive speeds.
Yeah, but I think I've seen some report of actually there are robots that can hook up to their tail and sort of...
Yeah, yeah. But I've never seen a snake do that. That would be cool. I've seen a beetle do it, I think.
Yeah, well, anyway, with snake robots, we have many options of moving in various
very
interesting
important
ways. So.
And as far as I know, the additional gates that a snake can't do, I mean, that's basically the wheeled gate that we have in a car. I mean,
I wouldn't dare to say that a biological snake can't move in certain ways. Because
no, we just haven't seen
it. You cannot prove that. We just haven't seen that.
They're amazing animals. Did you go in? You didn't do any work on legged bike,
No.
But that's interesting. The joint between basically the vertebrates of your modular robotic snake is quite special, I understand. We're gonna have some videos up on the site. We're gonna have some pictures, maybe. But could you explain to me or to the listeners? What was your intention when you designed it, and that's why it ended up the way it was?
If you look at the kinematics of a joint, there are some things that may not be obvious from the start. Many joints are designed as universal joints, but if you look at it mathematically, it's important that the joint can rotate in a certain way. If you look at a joint from each side, the roll motion should be equal from both sides. Because if you don't have that, you can put the snake robot in such a position that a load at one end will amplify towards the other end, and that can, in certain configurations, break the robot.
Yeah, we don't want that.
Also, if you have a cable going through the robot, conveying, for instance, power or information, you don't want that to be twisted.
No. So, that's a major issue.
That's also one thing. And then when you control the robot, you would like the joint to be mechanically constrained so that you can control pitch with one motor and roll with another motor without having them coupled.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if they are coupled, that can also lead to quite difficult load problems with the robot.
What could happen is that we could configure our robot and then apply a load that in another configuration would be okay, and in this configuration it would break it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and that,
exactly.
Then we had to constantly consider these these load conditions, and it's much better to solve them all at once in the joint, and then we could just ignore
them. Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
This the joint that you designed, the connector is called the Dragon connector. I know. Yeah. Did you have any
Dragon joint?
Dragon joint. Yeah, Dragon joint. This is going to be a popular show in China. Everybody's going to search for Dragon. But that's really interesting. So you filled the different requirements you had on the joints. No twisting of the cable. No undesired configurations. And
well, some requirements, but there are still requirements that it's not a perfect joint so far. Mm-hmm. It's more a proof of concept.
So where do our listeners? Where should they focus their work? Could you briefly mention some of the requirements that you think that, okay, I've got them pretty well nailed down?
That it's possible to do.
Yeah, you know that it's possible.
Then the question is how practical, you know, cost and weight.
Aha, okay. And so take the same thing, but do it cheaper and do it easier to manufacture.
Better. And there is also some difficult problems with backlash in spherical joints.
Uh-huh.
That's a difficult problem, because if you have a spherical joint, mm-hmm. that means a joint which is moving in three dimensions,
mm-hmm.
then you can see mathematically that a backlash is very difficult to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
That this would be a general problem for all spherical joints. So you have to have very precise mounting of bearings and things like that.
And that makes it technically hard and expensive. And
yes.
And also, I guess, wear and tear will come into the picture there, that as you use the precision will be reduced, and then
yes,
we have...
Yeah, that. Yeah. I believe that you probably need to make your design so that the configuration is not, or the application of this robot is not dependent on high precision configuration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We could also use some feedback loop where we say that, okay, this joint is worn this much and this joint is worn that much, and then we simply adapt to that fact.
Huh? Maybe, yeah.
So we use the intelligence instead of the mechanical precision.
Yeah.
So that was the now we come to the connector. I mean, I've talked to many people over the years about the connector, because we know that we have I would call it an absurd amount of requirements, and we're putting a lot into this poor connector. And when you worked a lot with the self-alignment. When physically introduced to each other, they should, as high likeliness as possible, grip each other in the correct way. And so your connector, the Dragon connector, there's no like a final version of it. It's still work in progress, I see. I understand.
Well, I have a final version of it, but I mean, there is still a lot more work that needs to be done to do things really practical. You know, there's the overall requirement, I would say, robustness of the connector is important. Robustness includes a lot of things that, if you want to, as you very quickly discovered when you start to work with connectors, mm-hmm. is that it's very easy for a connection attempt to fail if you just miss a little bit, or if something is a little bit dirty, or
the fouling problem is a big one. I know.
Yeah, it's. And it's actually an old problem. Even in the space programs, this has been a very very critical thing to docking of
spacecraft.
Spacecraft, yes. And if you have studied these, you see that when they do this, this is a very slow process.
Mm-hmm.
And when you want to do this in practice, you cannot spend such a long time. You want to be able to smash things together, and then they should sit there reliably.
And also maybe they should fail reliably if they do not align.
Let's say gracefully.
Gracefully. Yeah. They should fail gracefully. They should not entangle themselves. They should not damage themselves. They should just miss, and we could try again.
Yeah, exactly. And so one primary design objective is the geometry. What shape should these connectors have?
Mm-hmm.
And there, from there, you can generate a lot of requirements.
And then and lots of different geometries, and then you test them, and one geometry has this advantage and that disadvantage.
Yeah.
How to balance them off against each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's really a key problem.
And then we come to manufacturability and.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. So the connector is a huge thing. Is there anything that, I mean, we have your connector. Is there anything that you think, any design principle that we. That you kind of found when you worked with a connector? Did you find any steps, any checks you used along the process that, okay, I have a geometry here, let's check it against these things and see, okay, it fails there, so it's not a good one? Or,
well, one overall principle, I think, for connectors or design in general would be simplicity. Just to make it as few parts and as simple parts as possible. Not a lot of little hooks or small motors or small actuators, but try to make the shape work as much as possible.
Yeah.
Of course, there are some small parts like locking devices that if possible, do it with the shape if you have to. But to the largest extent possible, to create a geometry of the connector that takes care of as much of the docking procedure as possible.
Yeah, passively, so to say.
Yes, exactly. Passive is very to the point.
Yeah, and the speed is also important, especially in connecting.
Yes,
that's the thing I haven't thought about before. That we have a speed in connecting and we have a speed in disconnecting.
Yeah,
there might be one connector that is fast on connecting but slow on disconnecting. Never reflected over that before. And of course the connector should do much more than bringing a physical connection. Did you see when you look at them that you had, for instance, we have the different forms of physical robustness? We have push pull, we have torques, and we have stuff like that. Did you see, it's hard to design a connector that are good at all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, you need to have, for a robust connection, you need to have robustness in all the 6 degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
That's absolutely necessary. One thing that I feel I realized was that the last part of motion need to be linear.
So we start the connection process, align, and then we have a linear step.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Huh.
Interesting, huh? And of course, then we come on to one of the or a few of the other requirements of the connector. Did you find any problems with integrating power and communication interfaces? Did you see that because I guess what we're talking is connection plates, basically.
Yeah.
Can they slip against each other? Should they just, in the linear step in the end, just push against each other?
I think they should slide a little bit against each other.
It roughs them up, huh?
Yeah. Or if something is, if some dust or something is on the connector, it's good if they slide a little bit to move that. Otherwise, they might be isolate.
Yeah.
There should be some spring action between connectors, and you cannot have too many poles because then
it becomes too complicated.
Maybe too complicated, yeah. And also for the connector, the symmetry means that when you connect, you may need to have some redundant connectors.
If you have 180 degrees or 90 degrees, or
yes, exactly.
Yeah, then
exactly.
You repeat the connectors each time.
Exactly. And you have a certain limited space for these connecting elements, the electrical connecting elements.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we could use all of them by simply kind of negotiating that, okay, now I'm connected this way, so we could use all our electrical and power connectors and not have the redundancy, but have a negotiation process in the connection?
Yeah, that's possible, but it makes the electronics a bit more complicated. Of course, the electronics will not consume that much space. And basically, you need power, electrical connections is mainly important only for power, because information you can transfer optically.
Yeah, yeah. And also, there is also interesting work with by Victor Kuo in Sydney using radio communication.
Yeah.
He solved the problem of crosstalk.
Yeah.
Because if you use radio, you have the crosstalk problem that you have many modular robotics communicating in the same volume. Yeah. But he basically used the proximity effect.
Yeah.
And eliminated that problem. And I think, do you think, I see it basically with the communication, with power, it's a harder problem, I think, because it's one thing we need to transfer as much of it as with as little losses as possible.
Yeah.
And that is one problem. But with communication, we have more options. We can do radio, we can do connections.
Yeah.
We can even use optical IR or laser.
Yeah.
And we can also, I mean, if one fails, the other one might work, depending on what makes it fail.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. When you were active in the modular robotics field, what inspirations did you have? Did you read the works of others?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But also, I think that biology is a great source of inspiration.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I think that much of the robotics world would benefit from looking even more at biology for inspiration and ideas.
Yeah, interesting. I know several people that get their inspiration from nature, both when it comes to algorithms and also to the physical design and development of their hardware. That's really interesting. And that basically brings us back to the snake robot, because the snake robot is, of course, heavily influenced by nature. So we're going to talk a bit about the overall control, the algorithmic part that makes the robot do what we prefer it to do. Do you have any input there for us?
Yeah, what I think again there is to have some inspiration from nature, which is not so far-fetched. I think that important for the robot is to do basis action on simulation. So it's a sort of model predictive control. That's maybe you're familiar with that. It's
I'll link to it in the show notes for the listeners too.
Yeah.
Can you explain a bit more about
so essentially the idea is for the robot to have or perform a simulation of itself in the environment a little bit ahead of it actually performing some action.
Ah, okay.
And it's sort of, I believe that most people, or at least many people, have the idea that before they do something, they think about the actions. Maybe just a fraction of a second before, So if, for instance, there is a glass there, if I see that there is water in that glass, I use a little bit different way, a little bit more careful way of lifting than if there is no water in that glass.
Yeah.
So basically, in my head, I have already the feeling of what it will feel when I lift that glass, and if that matches my actual feeling. Then that's okay, nothing will happen. But if there is a difference, then there's like, I have an interrupt signal, which means that I need to do some replanning here.
Yeah.
And I think this is also a way that we need to use to control robots.
Ah, yeah. So we're not trying to control them exactly now, but we're planning ahead.
We have a little bit, a simulation which runs a little bit ahead of the actual of the actual operation. And for this to work, we need to really simplify this simulation. We need to have a simple model of the robot that can be executed efficiently. The same as when we people do something, we don't, you know, when I lift the book, I don't care about the color of the book.
No.
The only thing is that it's flat and it has this weight. And then
it behaves the general way a book behaves.
Yeah, exactly. So for a model predictive control of the robot, we don't need a very detailed simulator, but we need something like the rough model of it. And then if there's a discrepancy between the reality and the robot, we need to maybe refine using a more detailed model. But if we do that consistently, I think we can actually do efficient control based on not that much computation. So only in when necessary we can go to a more detailed level. Then of course operation will slow down.
But it's also a smaller scope than when we're focusing in, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
And of course this will also allow us to prepare. So say that we're trying to pick up this glass, and we've never picked up this particular glass before. And for some reason it's not as we predicted it would be. It's heavier or whatever.
Yeah.
We could also have criteria to compare to. This is what I expect.
Yeah.
It is not as I expected it. Now I probably have to do this more advanced calculation.
Yeah.
But if I only have to do that a certain percentage of the time, I've made a big difference.
Yes, yes. Yeah. As I understand it, that's exactly the idea behind model predictive control.
Yeah. When we have modular robotics, we're probably going to have we're not going to have one very advanced video camera, but rather we're going to have more less advanced cameras.
Yeah.
Do you have any points of view on the sensor fusion there, where we use many sensors?
Yeah, I think sensor fusion is extremely important.
Yeah.
Just one camera will be slow, and we cannot have so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at a biological system, and if you look at the arm, we have on the order of tens of thousands of sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very efficiently, these signals are very efficiently combined in the cerebellum.
Mm-hmm.
In ways we are not completely sure how that works. That's actually what is my current subject of research.
Interesting. We will probably end the interview with you talking a bit about that. I usually do that, talk about what they're doing now and how they're seeing the future.
Yes. So one thing for these snake robots, if we take that as an example of a modular robot, they will need to have sensors all over them.
Mm-hmm. To interpret the surroundings they're
in. There's no single point we can put a sensor to give any kind of complete view, but we will need to have sensors all over them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, of course, sensing motor currents and maybe cameras, all kinds of modes of sensors. And these need to be combined by some kind of sensor fusion into
A view of the world. So.
Yeah, lower dimension signals which we can use for acting on.
Mm-hmm. Do you see it as a problem that the sensors will probably be less advanced than the single sensor we usually use in robotics today?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think we will have large numbers of bad sensors, like biological systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have lots of really bad sensors, but we have really outstanding ways of evaluating these sensing signals to extract just the information we need.
This is also good for us in many other ways. The bad sensors are cheaper than good sensors. They're smaller, they are less complicated and all.
Yeah.
And of course, when we have the fusion chip, the hardware and the software to fuse them, that's not going to be very, it's not going to require much power. It's not going to be, it's hard to get there, but it's not hard when we have it.
Well, we don't know yet. But biological systems can do this very, very efficiently and very elegantly. So there is a proof of concept already.
Yeah, we know that it's will
it
work.
Can be done. It can be done. We know that. Yeah.
Just that we haven't done it artificially yet.
No, exactly.
So that's very interesting. Do you see it, as possible today for us to control some very basic applications? If I came to you with a really, really simple use case, do you think, is the level of sensors and algorithmic control advanced enough to do the very basic first steps today? Or there's still a lot of research needed to be done?
Yes, on both questions. We can do a lot today, but there's an enormous amount of research still needed to be done. Yeah.
So you think that actually, if I came to you with a really, really simple application, we could actually do it?
When you say really, really simple, I don't know if that is the same thing as when I say really, really simple.
Yeah, that's really interesting to talk about. I mean, both for our technical listeners, but also for our other listeners. What is a simple solution? Where do you think us? Where are we today when it comes to this control and sensors and all that? I mean, could I make something that I could absolutely guarantee the customer it's not gonna hit you? It's not gonna approach you violently. It's gonna know you're there, even if it's just your small finger, and it's gonna stop. Do you think we could come to that level?
And I think that for the man in the street, simple usually means something that he or she can do easily.
Yeah, yeah, and that's not the state of robotics today.
No, exactly, exactly. You know, for roboticists, to just to make a robot stand up is quite complex.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really very complex.
Yeah.
Simple for a robot would be to bend a joint. You know, it's trivial for.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think that still simple things are still quite hard for a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And for modular robots, I mean, most things are really very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen that in the last Planetary Challenge, for instance. That it is a hard field we're working on. But it's maybe that's why we're here.
Yeah,
to solve the big hairy problem. Huh?
Because you know, I think that after working for a while with robotics.
Mm-hmm.
You come to appreciate the simple things we can do as a people, and especially if you have a child.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, imagine. I mean, you. I know you have children, and I've just had a small son. It's amazing what they learn, and how easily they do it.
And in two years, they are totally superior to any thing that the robotics research.
Thousands and thousands of robotics research hours, and a kid beats them in 2 years.
Yeah.
So that's an amazing factor. But it would be interesting if we could nail down this simple hard so that our non-technical listeners could know my idea. Is it impossibly hard, like knowing the weather 2 years from now, or is it hard, or is it possibly something we could try doing now? Could you mention something that, except bending the joint, could you mention some kind of a control thing that you've seen recently that kind of puts a pin in where we are today? We've seen these quadcopters doing reasonably advanced maneuvers when they fly. Is there any other example we could use?
No, the control of quadcopters is not that difficult, really. No. They are actually, from control theory point of view, they are quite simple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Simple devices. So that's not, for a roboticist, it's not that incredibly impressive.
We've seen the autonomous cars. They've gone through at least three challenges. The first one, I think the distance record was 800 meters. And the second competition, one car actually finished, as far as I know. And then they had this urban challenge where they built up an urban environment and tested the cars there with some success. Do you think that's a hard...
Well, you know, for me as a roboticist, I'm impressed by almost anything that roboticists do. Because I know myself from experience how difficult it is to do these things that for ordinary people may appear as trivial.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really very difficult for me to say very much about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... The complexity of the tasks that robots perform is often your intuition about the complexity is often quite wrong.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It may be much more complex or actually much easier than it appears to do. And it's very hard to judge unless you know what's happening behind under the hood of these.
So what we, for our non-technical listeners, we simply have to say talk to a roboticist and see what, if he looks very worried, it's probably not a good idea. If he looks enthusiastic, maybe we can get it done.
Well, the best idea is to study robotics and work a little bit on robotics to see what the problems are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it will still take a long time until robots will be able to operate as humans.
Mm-hmm. Do you see them never doing that, but performing the same tasks as we do, but not in the same way? I mean, I always find it funny that we try to make copies ourselves rather than just perform the task at hand.
Yeah.
I mean, if we tried to build a dishwasher that way, it would have been ridiculously complicated be an arm with a brush on it and stuff. Yeah. Now we built this machine where we actually have to put the dish in.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't clean dishes in any way resembling what you and I do.
The problem is that of general purposeness. Mm-hmm. You know, as humans, we are our hands and arms is extremely general purpose tools. Mm-hmm. if we specialize on only washing dishes, mm-hmm. then of course it's much easier to do it as a box. But this box will not be able to go to the shop and do some shopping for us.
You couldn't even wash your clothing, though. 95% of this, I mean, I guess it pumps water and detergent and flushes it around. And even though, and as I said, even though 95% of the machine is the same, we still need a washing machine and a dishwasher.
Yeah.
And that's not very good.
No.
Because in the end, you need a lot of machines.
So it's a general purposeness that makes it very difficult.
Uh-huh.
As long as we, if we specialize on something like winning Jeopardy.
Yeah, yeah.
No, robots or computers can do that very well.
Yeah.
But you know, if we do something that can win in Jeopardy and wash dishes.
Win one machine. And the Stanley Cup.
then I will be really impressed.
It should also do it without the. Of course, we could optimize for two tasks, but it should do so while the constructor not knowing which two tasks it was.
And maybe an unknown task that it is instructed that is it taught to do, and then it will be able to perform that well. Once we get there, then that is very impressive.
But it's also so that we might look at, I'm not of the opinion that we should try to replace ourselves with robotics or stuff like that. What we should do them is to empower ourselves. We should make our lives better and we should be able to do more things. That means that maybe we should try to sort out tasks that we don't think uses us to the full extent of our possibilities, and then leave the rest to robotics. And that also might reduce the scope. We can say, okay, if the robot does this 20 or 30 tasks, that might be okay for me. And the 200 tasks the 200 tasks that are a part of my daily life, I have to do 170 because it's simply too complicated to adapt the robots to all of them.
Yeah.
But if it can do the 20, 30, 40, 50 most boring ones, that might be a big, doing the dishes, for instance. My dishwasher is a great addition to my life.
Yeah. Yeah. If I had a robot which did the cooking, cleaning,
only
those two, that really, I would be prepared to pay quite a lot for such a robot because that takes a lot of my time.
Yeah, because it's also that we could then spend that time doing the taking care of our children, which is what we want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Spending time with loved ones, basically. Huh?
Yeah.
Usually I end the interviews with talking a little bit about what you're doing now and tying that into modular robotics. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, we mentioned the problem that robots need many sensors and need to integrate those sensing signals to make sense out of it and use that for control.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with a neurophysiologist in Lund, Henrik Jörntell, and he is a specialist on cerebellum in the central nervous system. Cerebellum is a part of the central nervous system that's located at the back of the head under a neocortex, and you can see it as a signal processor, a signal coprocessor for the brain. It receives all the tactile signals, sensing signals from the body.
So not eyes and ears, and touch
and also proprioceptive sensing signals, and combines these. And uses these signals for modifying the motor control signals. So it's part of the feedback loop in motor control, among other things. It's used for a lot of things. But it is involved in tasks that involve precision and high speed.
Okay. So for instance, typing and...
especially like juggling and walking on a line. And so all kinds of precision. You can actually survive without it. It's not life critical, but if you don't have it, you become very clumsy.
So if you have none or disease, it's hurt. There are tasks that, for instance, walking on a line or stuff like that you cannot do.
Yes. You generally become clumsy and slow. So it improves your visibly it improves your locomotion very much, and it uses. an enormous number of sensing signals. It's mm-hmm. able to extract information from these mm-hmm. for informing the brain of it and also directly combining or modifying the motor commands. Mm-hmm. Motor mm-hmm. commands. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with Henrik to find out exactly how this is happening, how this control system works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely interesting, and we are quite sure that this is can be applied. These methods can be applied also in artificial systems, that is robots.
What we could do is we could create an artificial version of this and bring this sensor, all this sensor data in, and do the same thing. So we have the top process that decides I'm going to grab the glass, yes. and then this does the fine control, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
Where in the time frame are we talking? Dozens of years from now?
No. This is we hope to have a publication within maybe the next year.
Ah, okay. And then within 5 or 10 years, we could probably have this artificial version. It's probably going to be software, could be hardware too, because it needs to be very fast, right?
Yes. I mean, there are some practical problems because the central nervous system is extremely parallel.
Mm-hmm.
It's really impressive in its efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And silicon is going that way too.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the natural systems have some features that are not so easy to reproduce in.
Mm-hmm. So do you see this as being only software, or is it going to be a mix of silicon and software? Do we need special chips for this? Or?
We don't know. Well, we don't need it. I mean, this can be done. I believe this can be done a lot purely in software.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because that's naturally a very big part in how fast we could introduce it and stuff like that.
Yes.
Very interesting. So that if we then bring this back to modular robotics to tie up the bag, so to speak, this means that if we build a solution and we have all these sensors, if we did it today the way the brain does it, we would be slightly clumsy. We wouldn't be fast enough in adapting to changes from the sensors. But if we then implement this layer between the higher functions and the really low functions, we would simply be smoother and faster. Huh?
Could be, but that's a little bit looking a little bit far ahead, I think.
Okay.
Right now we're at the stage of just seeing if things can work this way.
Ah, okay. Yeah, but that's going to be interesting to follow that work. And we're going to have a paper during 2012 then, huh?
Hopefully, yes.
Ah, very nice, very nice. So, thank you for listening, and thank you for participating.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. If you enjoy listening to the Robots Podcast, please support our bid to win the European Podcast Awards by giving us your vote. Voting's easy. Simply follow the link on our website at www.robotspodcast.com or add /vote to the web address. The competition finishes at the end of this month, so get those votes in as soon as possible. For now, though, thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Goodbye. Modular Robotics with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.